Ron Rappaport, welcome to the Bookshelf Conversation.
Ron, it's great to be with you. Thanks for inviting me.
So this is a bit of an unusual book, and it's a book that's right up my alley because it goes back a long ways in talking about baseball and baseball journalism. The title of your new book is Frank Chance's Diamond, The Baseball Journalism of Ring Lardner. Could you explain the title, Frank Chance's
Yeah.
Diamond?
Well, we all know that Ring started his career in essence in Chicago, where he became kind of was developing the new kind of sports writing with vernacular. Of course, the stories that he, you know me, Al, and all the rest of them caused the sensation. But he used some of that same technique in Chicago. Well, after he left Chicago, he went to a Great Neck, Long Island, which at the time, Ron, was the center of homes for tycoons and show business people and rich people, and the party scene was wild. It would roll from one lawn to the next, these great mansions. And Ring moved there, and he became pals with another writer who was hanging out there and spending a lot of time there with his family, a fellow named F. Scott Fitzgerald. And they became bosom buddies, drinking companions to be sure. But Fitzgerald got Maxwell Perkins, the great editor, and his editor collect Ring's stories, which had never been collected. He was a great fan of Ring. He helped him a lot. And their families were pals, and Ring and his wife were particularly taken by Zelda. They just loved her. They traveled. Well, Fitzgerald outlived Ring, and when he died, when Ring died, he kind of turned on his old pal. Let me read you a little bit of what he wrote here in a magazine. He told what a great writer he was and what he contributed to the literature, all the rest of it. But then he wrote, during those years, Fitzgerald wrote, when most men of promise achieve an adult education, if only in the school of war, Ring moved in the company of a few dozen illiterates playing a boy's game. A boy's game with no more possibility in it than a boy could master. A game bounded by walls, which kept out novelty or date, or danger, change, or adventure. However deeply Ring might cut into it, the cake had the diameter of Frank Chance's diamond. Well, that was kind of mean for him to turn on his old pal like that, but it was also kind of true. What he was saying was, and what other critics of the time who were taken by Ring, loved his stories, loved his use of the vernacular, loved the way he was bringing something new to literature. I mean, even Virginia Woolf, who didn't know second base from Buckingham Palace, was a fan of Ring's. But he didn't write the great American novel. He didn't try. And they considered that a failing. But Ring didn't want to. He once told his son, Ring Jr., the great screenwriter who won two Oscars, including for MASH, that if he were to write a novel by the end of the first chapter, he'd be more bored than the reader. He liked writing stories. He liked writing for the theater. He liked writing lyrics. He liked writing the things that he wanted to do, and he didn't care whether his literary reputation suffered the way others like F. Scott Fitzgerald did.
Talk a little bit about the evolution of sports in newspapers.
Well, I think they discovered, newspapers discovered that there was a great hunger for it. There was a time, I once did a biography of Bobby Jones, and there was a time when golf was such a big story that papers would print running stories like sometimes they would print, the box scores of baseball games incomplete just to show you that the Giants were beating. They would run scores of golfers' scores through the 9 holes or 10 holes or 12 holes. It was that big a deal, and it caught on. And baseball and horse racing and college football were the four big sports. Baseball, college football, horse racing, and boxing. Those were the big sports. There was no pro football to speak of. Basketball was out of the picture. There was nothing like that. And so I think they discovered that the papers discovered that sports sold the paper. And Ring and other writers in Chicago. Instead, the New York papers took sports and covered it the way they would cover politics, very solemnly. It was a serious business. And they would give you the hits and the runs and errors. going to the locker room was out of the question. Nobody ever thought of a thing like that. But in Chicago, writers like Ring started having fun with it. They started teasing the players. Ring would write poems in the players' names, and the players went along with it. He was covering the Tinkers, the Evers, the Chance Cubs. They were the lords of baseball. You know, they'd been in three World Series in a row and won two of them. And they had some fabulous characters, Frank Schulte, Jimmy Sheckard, Ping Bodie, what a nickname that is. And they all liked Ring because he played the piano and made up songs about what was going on in the world. And they were characters themselves, and they sort of let Ring run with it. So he would write poems in their names. He would invent feuds. And he and other writers in Chicago showed that sports was different from politics. It was different from straight, unquote, news. These were games played by boys. And they showed some of that. And Ring was the ringleader, pardon the pun, in that kind of writing. He wrote stories entirely in verse. He wrote letters to some of the articles would be letters to his boss back home. There would be talking about his travels, he would go to World Series. And when he was working for the Bell Syndicate now, he wasn't writing sports. He was writing a very popular newspaper column that appeared in nearly 100 papers, nearly 8 million readers. Didn't write a lot about sports, but every fall, he'd go saddle up and cover the World Series. And if he ever got the score in any of his stories in the World Series, it was a lapse on his part. He wasn't writing that kind of stuff.
Well, one of the things we see nowadays is the slow death of journalism, print journalism, as the internet takes over. I was lamenting the disappearance of magazines every year at this time, or earlier than this time. I would pick up, you know, Street and Smith's Baseball Annual, and the four or five other baseball annuals. I managed to get one, and I can understand why they're not popular anymore, because I don't know when this actually went to the printer, but as a Mets fan, they do not include a key acquisition they made over the winter. So it's already out of date.
Exactly. Listen, Ron, I worked for Sport Magazine. Is it still around? I don't even know. We put out a monthly, and we had to work 6 weeks ahead deadlines. So Street and Smith's, they had to work ahead. How can they compete with the internet that had it that day? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I'll tell you a funny story. Shohei Ohtani announced at time for the deadlines in Japan, in the Far East, that he was married. Huge news. In California, we woke up in the morning and found out that he'd made this announcement at like 2 a.m. L.A. time and had to catch up with it. I mean, that's the way the world works now. Street and Smiths can't compete. I know those magazines you're talking about.
No.
Sport used to put out auxiliary magazines that would be about football and baseball, and I would write for them and edit them and so on. But you were working way in advance to put out a magazine. That's why every year there was a story on Mickey Mantle. Every year there was a story on Willie Mays. You could sell that on the cover, you know. But to try to keep up with the daily or the weekly grind, no way.
Well, let's talk about the editing process that you do. How, of the thousands of stories that Ring must have written, how do you go about parsing them out and picking the ones that appear in your book?
Well, the first question, we need to back up a little bit, was finding these stories. Some of them had not been read or published since they saw the light, since they were published in the paper 100 years ago, Chicago Tribune. The Bell Syndicate was, I was looking up, finding columns in the Omaha World Herald, the Joplin paper, the Springfield Mass paper, Boise, Idaho paper, and they'd all be running Ring's columns. And I had to go in sort of a treasure hunt through the old files, through the old, you could see the whole page, you know, the whole imprint of it. And it took some time. It was kind of fun. But you're right. He was a beat guy. He started out, he covered the Cubs, hits, runs, and errors. And he did pretty well. Even then, he showed some example of, he'd make a turn of phrase that showed he was destined for bigger things. But he was writing game stories. And he wrote a lot of them, and I had to pick and choose, and it wasn't easy. I did a bigger book on Ring's journalism, The Lost Journalism of Ring Larder, 5 years ago, and that included his writing on boxing and college football and politics and his family and life in Great Neck and all the rest of it. And I included a section on baseball. When I decided to do this book, I found the stories that I had left out. There were about a dozen of them, and Ron, they were just as good as the ones I had included in the original book. So it was kind of fun to put those stories back in. Now, this book still includes a bare minimum of all the stories Ring wrote. When he was writing for In the Wake of the News column, they wanted him to write every day, every single day. And at that time, he was writing Champion and Gullible's Travels and the You Know Me Al stories, the Busher stories, at the same time. And Jonathan Yardley, the Pulitzer Prize winning critic, who was Ring's biography, said the mere fact that while he was writing fiction, the quality of his journalism was so consistent is one of the great triumphs in American journalism. He wrote every day, and he said, "Ring, we need your name in the paper every day." He said, "Well, how about putting in Ring Lardner's writing today?" Because he was writing so much. No, there was a wealth of material, and I had to use my own judgment as to which ones to use. It wasn't easy.
What about, now you mentioned towards the beginning of the book about the, I mean, there's certainly a difference in the language that they used in those days. It was much more, I won't say poetic, but it was certainly more flourishy.
Well, yes, they everybody wanted to try to put their own spin on it and make it different from just the run of the mill. What Ring did, his great contribution, was to use a dialect. The vernacular, not dialect, but the vernacular, how people spoke. That's why people like H.O. Mencken and great critic Edmund Wilson and others and Fitzgerald and Virginia Woolf and more were, for instance, Virginia Woolf said, "Ring Lardner is a great writer, even though the language he uses is not exactly English," which is pretty good. Because he was experimenting with the language and succeeding to such an extent that he was very much admired. He was writing in the era of Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Dos Passos and the rest. And they all checked in on Ring to see what he was doing. Hemingway was younger than Ring. And when he was in high school in Oak Park, Illinois, he would sign his columns for his high school paper, Ring Lardner Jr. That's how much he was taken. That's how much he was taken by him. But for instance, there are some long pieces that he wrote for the American magazine. I don't know what it was. But these pieces run 5,000 words, and I couldn't resist including two of them, even though they, were long. One was Ty Cobb, and one is a piece on Christy Mathewson. And both of these pieces are in dialect, or in vernacular. He's telling the story. "Listen to me, young fella." He's like the old timer telling him. Mm-hmm. What is this about was? And he's spelling chance, C-H-A-N-C-E-T, he chanced to, all the way through. And you read the story, and he loved Mathewson, adored him. There's another article, one of his famous articles about when Mathewson lost a game in the World Series that's often quoted. But this one goes on and on and on, and you read it the first time, and you see how much his love for Mathewson, and he explains a lot about his appeal and what a great player he was, and includes a lot of wonderful stuff in it. You read it the second time, and you see that he kept up this vernacular for 5,000 words. It's amazing, amazing journalist achievement, I thought. And I think that's one of the reasons people were taken by it, is that he kept it up. He kept it up. I don't know how he wrote as much as he did. He had four young boys. He was dealing with the social life in Great Neck. He called himself a two-bottle man. He and Thomas Meehan, a famous at his time, silent movie actor. That means two bottles a day, and he wasn't talking about lemonade. He was part of the Algonquin Round Table. He went to the theater a lot. He made send-ups of operas. These are in the original book. He wrote, and had a very busy life. He traveled, went to Hollywood, visited the Fitzgeralds in the south of France. His wife. I don't know where he had time to do all this stuff. To turn out all this writing, it's a great mystery.
Given how long ago he wrote, who is this book for?
Well, it's for people like yourself who are followers of the game and the dead ball era and the rest of it. This is all stuff. Most of it was written 100 years ago or more. So there are a lot of baseball scholars and devotees out there like yourself. I was just at a conference in Phoenix where there were all kinds of, you know, who writes books about sports, about athletes, is academics. And for some reason, it's a great switch from lecturing in the law school, that kind of a thing. So there are a whole, you know, as well as I, there's a whole bunch of people out there, the fans who listen to your reports here. But I also think some younger people who are picking up on getting tired of the internet, there's a sense of that. People have had enough and they want to go back and they want to see how things were. And I think it might be for fans maybe, but also for, when I told the publisher who I was aiming it for, it was for the baseball fan, but also for the literary crowd, the people who want to see another side of Lardner. They've read all his stories. They've read, maybe seen his play, wrote a great musical on Broadway. Who want to see, now here's another look at it from another point of view. This is the journalism. And I thought it might be interesting for them too.
Did you have trouble finding a publisher?
No, it's a funny story. I don't mind telling it. The original book was published by University of Nebraska Press. It's a big book, 600 pages, because I covered a lot of stuff. And they have a great line in sports books and sports journalism books. Mm-hmm. But for whatever their reason, they didn't want to do the paperback. Fine. So we took it to Lions Press in Connecticut. And they were great. They said, yeah, sure. I'll tell you the reason I went to Lions is that they had published a book on Damon Runyon's horse racing a year or two ago. I figured, well, if they did Damon Runyon's horse racing, maybe they'd want Ringlardner's baseball journalism. But I got to tell you that the title of their book on Runyon's horse racing journalism was, I thought the title of the year, it was, I Got the Horse Right Here. Anyway, they were up for it.
And
there are a lot of publishers out there, you know. There are a lot of publishers out there who, you know, aren't looking, you know, understand that it's going to be a limited thing. The limited audience, and my advance proved it. It was a labor of love, something I wanted to do. Also, I was lucky enough to be in touch with two of Ring's grandchildren, James Lardner, who was Ring Jr.'s son, and Susan Lardner, who was John's son. Now, John Lardner was a great sports writer in his own right in the 50s and so on. He was a great writer. So it was, and they gave me permission to write the books, to use the material. They were very good about it. So I enjoyed the time I spent with them.
Did you need permission to do this?
The first book, yes, because the second book they pointed out, Ring as of 2023, is in public domain. So I didn't need permission, but I wanted them to know what I was doing. The first book I did need them to sign up, and Susan was then the literary executor. I think James is now.
Wow.
They're great people. What lovely people. But imagine thinking that these are Ring's grandchildren.
It's quite a legacy. Do you have anything in the hopper? Anything coming up that you're working on?
I've got a couple of things. As I say, between assignments, I got a couple of things I'm looking at, but nothing at this moment. I've been writing and editing and doing books for a long time, ever since I, quote, retired from the newspaper business, the late lamented newspaper business that you were talking about. You know, whenever guys of our era get together, we say to ourselves, we were in the golden age. Papers were printing millions of copies. They had huge space. I mean, I worked for the LA Times when the sports section was as big as the whole paper is now. They had lots of money. They had lots of space. Oh, sure, go write that. Get on a plane. Go do whatever you want. It was wonderful, especially to write a column when you could choose where you wanted to go, you know. And the one question I have, Ron, and I'm not sure, I have an answer to it, is did we appreciate it? I'd like to think we did. We had a good time and we enjoyed it. And I feel bad for the people who are, I mean, the LA Times fired four of their beat guys. They just laid off 170 people. Well, they hired two of them back because two people took buyouts, two of the, you know, the people had been around a while. But we had a ball. I wouldn't change a minute of it. And the people that I talked to, and you would know the names, John Julian and Lee Montville and Dave Kindred, that crowd of great writers. We had a great time. We really did. And I feel like I've got survivor's guilt when I look at what's going on in newspapers today.
Yeah.
Every day there's a new saga with Sports Illustrated. There was something new today. They just got sold to somebody.
Oh, really? Finally?
It was either will or won't keep the monthly magazine going. It's sad. It's really sad.
It is very sad.
Yeah.
I want to go back to one thing about the editing process that you
Sure.
do. How do you edit something like that that a great writer has done? How do you feel about the responsibility of editing?
Well, with Ring, it was a very interesting case. I'll tell you why. He would write stories in the vernacular, and the copy editors would change them. For instance, he wrote, there were a couple of instances. One was happily married man. Got it? Happily, HAPLY. And the guy in the copy desk would say, that's not right. He changed to happily married man. We do it, getting rid of the joke. You know, there were other things like that. It would drive him crazy. Well, I would go through, these are the Bell Syndicate columns now, and they appeared in this paper and that paper and the other paper, and they each paper would edit it differently. So I had to figure out which one was right. And sometimes I had to use my own judgment. What was Ring really saying here? And I did the best I could, and I think I apologized in the introduction for using my own judgment here into what it was Ring was saying. The only thing I can say in defense of the copy editors is that he must have driven them crazy too, because they didn't know what he was doing, you know. And this was the day, these were the days of Western Union. You sent this stuff in. There was one wonderful line. Hugh Fullerton, the great Chicago baseball writer, was Ring's mentor. So one day they're in the South, and somewhere spring training and Georgia or someplace, and they filed their they Ring's copy and Fullerton's copy they gave to the Western Union guy. All right, so Fullerton checks with them later and he says, did you get those stories? He said, yeah, yours was fine, but that other guy, I spent an hour trying to fix all this mistakes, all the silly mistakes. Well, I hope Fullerton didn't tell Ring, because it would do exploded, you know. But I mean, that's the kind of thing that was going on.
And we
But
have been talking.
I'm glad you're interested in the editing press,
Yeah.
because it really was, you had to use your own judgment.
We've been talking with Ron Rappaport, editor of Frank Chance's Diamond, the baseball journalism of Ring Lardner. It's a must-have for any old fan of the old game. And Ron, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Good to be with you, Ron. Thanks for having me on.